This is EdgeCases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Wolf French.
And what's our topic this week, Wolf?
A few of my favorite things.
Just a few, huh?
I'm trying to limit the show.
How would you define a few? What's the numerical range of a few?
I'm defining it this evening as three.
Three, okay.
Yes.
Fair enough. What's the Terry Pratchett thing? You know, one, two, many, lots, right?
It's vague remembrances of maybe something like that, but yes. Okay.
All right, fair enough. Okay, so I have a bit of follow-up from the last episode. Let's see, so it's last episode was about accessibility, and I got a tip from actually a coworker of mine, and he's on Twitter as Destroyo, so I'll put that in the
Twitter handle. Yeah,
that's I know. That was when I first heard that, I was like, what? Wait, what? And he emailed me to say that in regards to our question about whether you get a notification when the voiceover announcement is done, and apparently you do. If I had looked at the actual APIs, then I would have seen it. There's a notification called UI Accessibility Announcement Did Finish, which is available as of iOS 6, which apparently gets called when the announcement is over. In theory, it also gets called when the announcement gets interrupted. So it's over, but it's over because it was stopped by something else. And I saw this quite a bit in my testing of accessibility, that it was very easy for, when you're just kind of swiping to get from one thing to another, you're usually interrupting an announcement because the announcement is the entire word. Mm-hmm. So it would be very helpful to be able to say, well, when it was interrupted, that's when you get notified. But I did see at least one Stack Overflow entry saying that, well, yes, we get the notification when the announcement finishes in its totality, but not if it gets interrupted. So maybe that isn't quite so helpful.
Do you get any like user info or object dictionaries that actually tell you which element is currently speaking?
I believe they do. There's
okay. That's handy.
String value, something. I was just looking at this right before we started. There's a number of things involved, and it is documented.
Okay, great.
So it should help you, whether it actually does or not. I suppose you can find out, but it should. And actually, one thing I found out myself was after an interesting thing that I saw in code was that one of the things you can do, like you can really twist the API. Because remember, the API gives you the ability to set accessibility traits of various properties on anything because it's a category and it's an object. And so you could, for example, when you are setting a string as a title for a UI element, you could pass along as part of that string the accessibility title if it's going to be different. Mm. So for example, if you had a title which you wanted to have broken over two lines because that would make it fit into the element, the UI element, mm-hmm. but you wanted the voiceover to have one uninterrupted string, you could say, well, I don't need to give you two strings. I'll give you one string, but then I'll attach the voiceover element to it, and then the API would know to extract it from that object. And so that's kind of cool and kind of weird. But of course, if enough people do that, then you could never switch to just having it be something on a UI view because people are taking advantage of the fact that it's really on anything mm-hmm. at all. So that's probably one reason why, Apple does that, why probably it leaves it like that because enough people are doing tricks like that to it. Mm-hmm. So that's it for me.
Okay. Well, first, this was a bit of a test. I wanted to see if you would, as part of the, I don't know if this would really be follow-up, but I wanted to see if you were going to mention that this is our 75th anniversary.
Oh, I was going to.
I think maybe that's the magic's gone. You don't bring me flowers anymore.
Well, no, 75th is gold, isn't it?
I looked it up, and the problem is, like, with these medals and stuff like that, like, it's really kind of hinged on, like wedding anniversaries. And right. By 75th anniversary, you're pretty much close to dead. And so So I think gold is like 75th. I forget what 50 is, but 50 I think is pretty. I mean, most people don't make it to 50 either. So it's like, well, of course we're totally cheating by recording every week.
It's a week, right? We're using internet years.
There we go.
But it's also our first episode of 2014.
Yes, that's actually ties into my next part follow up. But I want to mention that we actually don't have like an end plan here. I mean, we kick this thing off with barely any idea of what we're doing, which we still don't know what we're doing. But
do I know what you're doing?
Well, I know that like Hypercritical ended at 100 episodes.
That's right.
And so are we going to end at 100 episodes? Although I noticed that a lot of other podcasts have blown right through their 100 episodes.
Yeah. Well, once you hit three digits, it's very hard to go to the fourth digit, right?
Right. So that's the equivalent to the 75th anniversary of real wedded people, and. I mean, it could be that maybe we do like we'll call the first 100 episodes our season one.
Yeah. No. Who was doing that? Who
that
did
was
that
just a tip.
Oh, okay.
But they did.
I was also thinking Core Intuition with Daniel Jalkut and Manton Rees. Mm-hmm. They said in their most recent episode that they would consider, this is a new season. New year is a new season for them. I'm not sure I'd go that far, really.
Yeah.
But. I would wait until one of us gets replaced, right? And then that's, that would be like a new season of the show.
You're like going to replace with me with Mac and Talk and going to type out everything I'm going to say. I know what's going on.
With voiceover.
There I go. That's it's foreboding, foreshadowing there. So I don't know about you, but, I've had this task paper document since we started recording. And it's funny, the items that are on the bottom of the task paper are really from the earliest episodes where it's kind of ideas of things I would talk about. Like it's kind of like my safety reserve, kind of money in the bank, the things I can bring up that in case I'm really reaching for I've scraped the bottom of the barrel and I'm like, okay, I'll start digging into this. I still have so much to talk about, so maybe I have this big blabbermouth.
You want me to comment on that?
You could let the sleeping dog lie. And an interesting thing is that with this, I also feel kind of like a sense of pressure with, 75 anniversary is that's only 25 episodes left, and then we have to split it up. That's, 12.5 episodes between both of us. And I feel like I should start tackling these topics that have been kind of lingering at the bottom of my task paper forever.
Just in case we actually end at 100.
Yeah, yeah.
We have no plan to do so.
And one of the reasons why I realize that I've kind of haven't been giving you these topics and because they're kind of research heavy and they're kind of big topics to take on. I mean, the sequential consistency one, I put in a good amount of research into because I wanted to make sure I totally understood it. And so this also is kind of Hypercritical-ish where, Syracuse being the madman he is, that he had to, do the Accidental Tech podcast where he doesn't do extensive research because, man, that stuff takes a lot of time. I know that you in the golden years before, in golden days before you got all lazy, that you used to do Xcode projects and upload them to GitHub before.
There will be more Xcode projects.
I don't think I guess I pretty much just go and talk about my existing projects, so that's how I do that. But anyway, so that was I just wanted to bring up the 75th anniversary, a little retrospective there. Although I guess it didn't retrospect very much at all. So so another failure.
Lordy, I don't want to talk about the old episodes.
Another failure on my part. Okay. and so for a real follow up here, so in episode 31, The Turing Frights, I talked about Singularity, Microsoft's research operating system. And so there was this last week, which would have been totally fresh and kind of oddly topical for us if we actually recorded last week. But there was this article on CNET called that was titled A Non-Windows OS, Microsoft Drops Clues. And basically the thrust of this article was linked to his blog post of one of the R&D guys at Microsoft talking about Midori and basically the kind of the Singularity stuff. And also there was I don't know if that was actually mentioned in the blog post, but apparently the Midori project has been kind of moved to the group that's responsible for next generation operating systems at Microsoft. And the idea here is that, this proves that Midori is actually going to be Windows, they're up to Windows 8 now, so Windows 9 or something. I would love to be the case, because I think Singularity is very promising. But from what I could tell by reading the article and reading the blog posting and all that, I think there's this kind of like reading too much into kind of a bureaucratic shift of moving people around and kind of.
Yeah.
And I mean, Midori is a fantastic concept, and I'm a big fan. But to get that, for it to be the next Windows, I mean, Windows has massive compatibility headaches. Well, part of it, I would recommend that everyone listen to that episode if you're interested in Singularity and Microsoft stuff. But one of the benefits of it is that you could...
Although keep in mind that this is not the Singularity. Their Singularity.
Singularity, yes. Terrible name, as I mentioned before. But one of the benefits of it is that you can turn off things like virtual memory, like the TLB. And that gives you 3-4% performance increase right off the top there. And God, you're not going to be able to do that if you're going to try to emulate Windows 95 APIs or whatever. The article... I guess the blog posting did mention M#, which is a set extension to C# that gives it things like channel contracts and design by contracts type stuff, and the type of thing that Singularity takes use of. Which really sounds like more of an evolution of Sing#, which we mentioned on the episode. And so it didn't seem like altogether groundbreaking. I think it was one of these things where there's a few shifts that happened kind of at the same time and kind of got picked up by the mainstream media, as it were. And so that's reached kind of the... kind of the mainstream there. So I saw a few people tweeting links to it. But it did cause me to do something that normally I never do, is listen to our own episodes. I know, it's terrible. I suffer for you. And I was struck by, like, it was odd because it was the first episode of 2013. And... I apparently had decided that I wanted to be all optimistic and kind of talk about something that I like instead of complaining all the time like we usually do. And obviously, I'm a big fan of Singularity. And so I really liked the kind of the optimistic take on it. I thought it was also very fitting. It does happen to be here we are recording the first episode of 2014, and just by the luck of the draw, I also am recording the first episode of 2014 as my topic. So I figured that I would kind of talk about some other of my favorite things that I hope will come to pass. So I have three things: image-based development environments, code bubbles, and prototypal objects. And so we'll take these one by one. So I was listening to a friend of the show, Peter Hosey, on NS Brief 114. And he mentioned something that I had known, but it's been so long that I hadn't thought about it in a long time. And he mentioned, like, did you ever see the Steve Jobs demo when he was, like, wearing a suit and demoing basically Next development environment? There was like a YouTube video that went around. I think they even have a link to it in that episode.
I might have. I remember. Let's see. Yes, because I used WebObjects mm-hmm. back in the day. It was by the time WebObjects, that they were back at Apple.
Yeah.
But I probably saw something along those lines.
And yeah. So it's very interesting because there's like a Gemini thing going on here or something, where there's always interface builder, and there was project builder, and later project builder became PBX, project builder X or 10, I guess, and then became Xcode as we know it today. And thus recently with Xcode 4 kind of subsumed interface builder. But they're like these two sides of the development coin. And it's really interesting that Xcode was always kind of the project builder side of things, was kind of the code side of things. And interface builder was kind of more the object way of looking at your, like, live objects, kind of freeze-dried objects, as I like to call them, way of looking at your app. And for one reason or another, interface builder that got subsumed into Xcode. And I think it reflects kind of a priority type thing, and maybe even a functionality thing. Because one of the things that with Steve Jobs' demo, like Peter Hosey was mentioning, that back then they had something, the predecessor to EOF, which was dbkit. And he was showing how you could, like, you know, create a window, drag a table view over, and create these dbkit connection, database connection objects to start populating your database table and make things editable and kind of build like a master detail kind of view. And you were doing this all just by hooking things up, and you're dealing with essentially live objects. And at what's really telling is that at no point did he actually fire up Project Builder at all. That this was all an interface builder kind of demo, right? And there was this entire thing back in those days called Nibware, where this was back when Interface Builder had plugins, which was another thing that's been dropped, and where like the type of low code things that they couldn't do, you could write these Interface Builder plugins that would allow you to do those extra things. And there was, you know, entire thrust as like instead of using interface builders as like a place where you lay out your UI widgets, that actually was a development environment almost in its own right. And so as Apple developers, we actually have this kind of rich history of this idea of dealing with real live objects and away from kind of the source code. And obviously there's source code kind of beating underneath, but so this is the idea that you actually can like develop with real live objects instead of having to kind of go with Xcode. And I think it's no accident that Xcode's icon is a blueprint. That, I mean, when you look at like you're building a house, right? And like walls are heavy, they're hard to move. So it like really makes sense to like sketch things out ahead of time and decide where you put the wall here and that's it. But, you know, with software, like, you know, we don't have like these troublesome laws of physics, right? And in the software world, we can totally just move walls just by thinking about it and moving things around. And for me, it's like the kind of dealing with the Xcode or the Project Builder way of looking at development environment, where you define your classes and of course two files, and writing out a bunch of code, and then you get to actually build and run. It's very laborious. It's very static. It feels like we have all this pomp and.
Well, it's legacy. Feels like a legacy project.
Yeah. It feels. I mean, this is, and like I want to say this is how we did in the olden days. But of course, with Smalltalk systems in the olden days, like they didn't have this. And so
for a certain value of we didn't do this.
So it's. It does feel to me almost like a Devo type thing, where it's de-evolution, where it's like for one reason or another that we're actually kind of moving away from a live object kind of development environment. And I was thinking about it, and I think part of the reason is and why like Interface Builder kind of got subsumed. I think the iPhone had a big impact on that, and that obviously when the iPhone came out at first. I guess you did have nibs, but it was very, the idea was you defined all your interfaces in code. I forget, was that actually iOS the first release? You could use nibs for that, right?
You could, yes.
Yeah. Maybe it was just Apple's own apps didn't have
Apple's own apps, yeah. Okay. I don't believe they had all of the infrastructure in place for that. So like the people who were doing, the apps that were through, jailbreaking, couldn't use Interface Builder.
Okay, that must be it.
And I think the other part of it is that since so many new people were coming into the fold from, you know, Windows or elsewhere,
right.
And saw Interface Builder as this weird, crazy thing that was not like anything they had ever dealt with, a lot of apps were started to be rewritten in code more than Mac apps normally were. Mm-hmm. That also added to it.
Yeah. I think maybe storyboards, for better or for worse, are kind of turning the tide there where... a lot of developers seem to be using them, again, especially with the for worse part. But this idea is like you're in a very resource-constrained environment. And I get the feeling that it's like almost feels like you can't afford Interface Builder at that point. As I don't, and don't know. This is like, it almost feels like this like a cultural thing with the iPhone, that it didn't lend itself as much to interface builder as, say, desktop apps were.
Well, and also the UIs are so much simpler.
That's true.
That it's easier to just throw things into code.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting that the entire auto layout thing came in the era of the iPad, which obviously can afford more complicated user interfaces. So Smalltalk had this thing where you didn't really deal with source files, and you dealt with images. So you'd create classes and you'd create methods in these things called browsers, and you'd be able to just kind of it was almost like a documentation tool, but one that you could type code into. So it would list all your classes, all the methods of a class, and you just could add classes or read the source code and add methods and so forth. And it would end up storing all this into images, which are this, and I'm not talking like JPEGs or something like that, but these are essentially very much like nibs, that these were serialized object graphs. And so part of the reason why you don't use these images is because they have a few cons. Number one is that I would say it's just an interchange type problem, where these Smalltalk images, even though they're documented, I mean, when you look at, you know, like a Unix directory tree with header files and C files in there, like, that's very kind of lowest common denominator type stuff. And that's, you know, stuff that goes back to the 70s and which we're still using today. So it's something that everyone pretty much understands, and it's really simple. And the Smalltalk images are internally much more complicated. So, and as you evolve those formats, you have to write like migration tools or whatever, where files and directories are pretty straightforward and everyone supports those. there's the issue of diffing, where as you make changes, and I've made changes to my image, and you're making changes to your image, and getting those together with Smalltalk type systems, and now those merges can be problematic. And there are all sorts of mitigations to this, and really it's the same problem as we have with file system today. You use something like Git, you can bolt on top of it, and you have agreements on how things go. But I think we're actually in a pretty good time here, where we've done a lot of stuff with eventual consistency type systems, and Git can even be kind of argued to be an eventually consistent kind of database system, where you can, I don't know if you've looked in how like things like CouchDB work, but these are systems that are meant for like offline changes you can make to your local data store, and then later on you can sync up. And with the CouchDB system, you're not actually going to lose data. Although if you have merge conflicts, it will just pick the last right wins type stuff, but it'll still hold on to the old stuff for you. And so I think that if we had as we mentioned, like, you know, you take nibs, and we complained about this on an episode before, said, like the old nib format was not mergeable at all in a system like Git, and that was a problem. The newer format is more mergeable. You still can, I mean, you can get clean merges out of it now, which was, you'd be very lucky if you could with the old format.
Yeah.
And so I think that with a Couchbase like system, or with a well thought through kind of file format like we have in the new zip format, is that I think this could actually be much more workable, having an image-based format for actually storing live objects in our app. So the development environment for that, the development experience would be a little bit different. And so I'll kind of walk you through how I'd like to see it work. Is that, so imagine that you fire up you put your iPhone into, you know, development mode. And imagine that you get essentially a plus button on your home screen that says, hey, create a new app. So you press it on your iPhone and launches. And it comes up with a blank screen. And the idea here is that on your Mac, and probably eventually, throwing back to, I think it was our first episode or maybe second with what they called iCode. But
yeah, our second episode.
The second episode, okay. That's right. I think I talked about like Cordata or something in the first episode. And So, I mean, probably eventually it'll be your iPad or something like that. But for now, consider it's your Mac. And so your Mac connects to your iPhone. And at that point, you basically get a Smalltalk-style browser where you can create new classes, you can create new properties on those classes, new methods, and you just can start creating objects and, you know, maybe hook up timers to them or UI elements. And essentially, that code would be shipped across the wire to your iPhone. And it probably would need to be something that's kind of dynamic. So maybe assume like an SQLite database that's storing these code fragments and instance variables and stuff like that. And so this would allow you to have a much more interactive development environment where you start with an app that's already running and you kind of build it. Instead of like the Xcode blueprint, it almost feels more like clay, that you start with this thing and you start molding it to what you want. And when you look at, you know, modern iPhone apps, it's really interesting in how, you know, we have this idea that your app, you know, you navigate a few view controllers down and you're looking at this one thing and then you start filling out a form and then you switch over and you go to Safari or something else and your app might get told to terminate because you're running out of memory. And so you're supposed to write out the state there. You're supposed to save it. And, you know, the standard toolkit classes that come with iPhone and iOS have definitely gotten more mature in that respect. They do a lot of the heavy lifting for you nowadays, but you still got to do some of that yourself. And what's interesting with this idea of having kind of these persistent objects that are stored in, say, SQLite database or something similar to that, is that that you get that type of behavior, which we kind of emulate today, is actually just kind of native in that type of system. The idea that these objects can come and go and they're persisted and they can be updated by a developer who plugs his Mac into your iPhone.
One thing about the way it works in Cocoa, the way it works or Zibs and Nibs and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. is that, and I think this is something that trips people up from other platforms, is that it is only the data. I mean, it's freeze dried in the sense that you can make the data in your yeah. interface folder document.
Yeah,
but it's entirely never about dynamic code.
That's true.
So that is one thing that if you wanted to do what you want to do,
yeah.
it would be a change from how Cocoa works now.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't get me wrong, there's definitely barriers in the way. There's this code signing in general. It's like this is what iOS is kind of designed to never allow you to do. Is that essentially this would be code being flung over the wire and you are executing it. Now, this is, I mean, it's...
Yeah, I hope you don't mind that I'm kind of thinking of this at this point as the pony episode.
You see, we actually, I don't know if you remember our conversation from many years back, but I was telling you how I wanted kind of live objects type stuff before, and you were having none of it. So this is one of the reasons why I was kind of glad we didn't record last week, because you said you couldn't actually interact with me too much because you weren't yeah, feeling well. Because I knew you'd give me a lot of pushback on this. But I don't think it's...
Go on.
I don't think it's... I'm not saying that we get rid of, you know, the blueprint style, Xcode style system we have today. That if you have a system that's reliant on creating tons of objects and is really highly dynamic in terms of like user entered stuff, I can make a case that really the kind of system we have today is more fitting for that. But I would say the majority of our software is actually something that we would prefer to be able to kind of mold up from the ground. And
well, you know what the app that Apple actually shipped that was closer to this idea is, and I don't remember the name of it. The one that was the one that used JavaScript. It was a separate app that was much simpler, and that was to make like little widgets, right? And it was supposed to be usable by people who didn't do programming.
Dashcode.
I mean, that's probably the closest that Apple ever came to that, because it, you know, you were supposed to be able to do it without even actually needing to code. Now, that was actually completely unrealistic.
Right.
Because you did eventually need to know JavaScript to really glue everything together.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you talk about dynamic stuff. You talk about stuff where you don't, you know, you can pass new stuff over the wire.
Mm-hmm.
That's as close as we're going to come. And unfortunately, Dashcode didn't survive up until iOS. But you'd have a lot more luck, I think, using scripting languages to do something like that rather than and thinking that you could get that out of an Objective-C environment.
I think things like F-Script show that Objective-C is a very dynamic language, and I think it's just it's kind of
becoming less so. I think under Arc.
Well, yes and no. Yes, they're heavily leveraging the static analyzer, but that's still stuff that can be done when you're with a dynamic language. So I think it's under Arc and the static analyzer is it's really a truly dynamic language that you need to breathe free and.
Objective-C.
There you go. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, things, especially like with code signing and all that, right? It's like, it almost seems like this is like be the ideal vector for the jailbreak community for injecting into that stuff. But the fact is that right now, you create code on your Mac that gets shipped over the wire and gets executed on your iPhone as a developer. I mean, this is unavoidable. I'm just talking about making it more fine-grained and building the development system on top of that. And another point is that when I talk about like storing like code inside to something that's really dynamic, like SQLite database or CouchDB, is that the first thing that a lot of developers would think of is like speed. Like this sounds like, well, imagine like when the user touches, launches your app for the first time, not only are you bringing up the SQLite code base or CouchDB code base or whatever Apple ends up shipping. Now you got to read in those objects piecemeal. You have the N+1 problem. You guys as following relationships, trying to build this, your class structure, where if you look at mock and how that works, it's basically an mmap where you have all your code is in the front of the file and you just memory map that into memory and you put your PC down and you go, your program counter down and you go. I'd like to say that it is totally feasible to take something that's highly dynamic, like a database structure for your code base, and thus have an optimization phase that actually spits out a mock code from it that follows all the relationships and writes out those disks to a file. This is almost like a ahead of time compilation technology.
A JIT, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not even just in time. It's actually ahead of time. So I wouldn't be too worried about that. I'm actually more concerned of all these things, all the cons I've been mentioning here, is that I'm most concerned about really kind of like the data formal longevity and also the Diffie type problem. Git has gone pretty good at terms of like we know how to diff and merge there, and we know when things go wrong how to deal with them. When you're dealing with complicated objects, merging is probably more problematic, and so I would actually, that is my primary concern. Okay, so moved on to the next thing I want to talk about is code bubbles. So if you go to codebubbles.org, unfortunately right now it's a redirect, but there's this great project that I've been following since it came out. I think it was like in 2007, 2008, something like that, from Andrew Bragdon and Steve Rice. I don't know, and a few other people, but those seem to be the major players involved. I think codebubbles.org redirects to Andrew's site, and if you Google codebubbles two words, Steve Reese's, apparently that's going to alternate how to pronounce his name, but if you go, it's I think brown.edu. That's actually a more promising site for you to look at. It's his own personal site. Ed Brown, and I don't know if you've seen the video on this code bubbles thing, Andrew.
Totally new to me.
Wow. Okay. This is great stuff. Either way is bad and either way is good. So it's probably just washes even. But code bubbles is if you. I guess you probably should search on YouTube for code bubbles. That's where last I saw the video on it, and I'm pretty sure it's still up. I think I saw that just like a month ago or something. And so the idea behind code bubbles is that they would say that it's very much focused on working sets, but I think that's for someone who's never heard of it before, as maybe too abstract a description. So I'm going to talk about a little bit how it works. And part of the problem is that, of course, we're constrained by audio here, and it's very visual. So I highly recommend you take a look at the YouTube video that actually walks you through it. It's a pretty short video, maybe 10, 15 minutes, something like that. And it's only like, if you're like me, it's like every other minute blows your mind. It's very, it makes you, it's a very good example of what I call the seed of discontent that make you very unhappy with the tools we're currently using. And so first part of it is in terms of like trying to visualize in your mind before you watch the video of what this type stuff is, what this does is that imagine a development environment that kind of focuses on methods first. Right now, you know, with Xcode, like first thing you see is your project, and then you deal with like, you know, groups, and then you deal with your files. And then only after like those few layers do you actually get down to the thing that actually that your app is made out of is the code itself inside the methods. And what CodeBubble does is that it hoists those almost up to the very top level. I mean, you still have the concept of a project, but the methods are brought right to the forefront, and the windows as they were are pretty much one per method. And with Xcode, you get this thing where it's like you know, usually you have one editor, maybe you have the system editor open, or you have those two editors going at a time. And if you're dealing with a few objects or classes interacting and collaborating with each other, this is so not enough. Really, and you need something that's more fine-grained. And one of the great thing about the CodeBubble's kind of system, how it works, is that because they only take up as much room as they need, you can see so much more at a time, because you're not dealing with a bunch of extraneous methods on top or class declarations or property declarations. It's just so you're looking at the stuff you want to look at a given time. And you end up having these facets into your source code database that shows you what you're working at the given time. And these windows end up kind of like when you – so imagine a small rectangle on your screen that has your – it's like an NS text view in it that has your code. And so you go to look at there's a message send in there to another method. So you open that up. Now, next code that if you're lucky, maybe you get the system editor going, or maybe you get the dual editor going. But with CodeBubble is that it will open up another window to the right of your original NS text view, and that will be yet another NS text view that has the declaration or the implementation of the thing you're interested in. And you can basically drill down there. It's almost like maybe the columnar browser that we have, the NS browser, but you can rearrange these things so they're not static at all. You have kind of a spatial awareness of them. This episode is tons of Syracuse debate, but you end up building these working sets where you have spatial information about how these text views essentially are pointing to each other. They have like arrows pointing to each other, and how they call each other. And what's really impressive is that these working sets are part of a larger canvas, and they have a pan bar where you can zoom in and out, and you can see large parts of the canvas, and you can basically mark saying that I'm trying to track down this one bug. So I know that this method calls this method calls this method calls this method, and I bring them all up at the same time, and I'm going to actually save all those. And I can write down little notes, like in little stickies that are right next to the text views or these code views. And then the real magic happens when you invoke the debugger, because then you can actually walk through these when you use the Xcode debugger. You kind of you build this mental map where you're like, okay, I'm looking at this function, but I know that I'm three methods deep, and I know that those are the stack frames over there. I just can't see them now. I could switch them if I want, but I know they're I know what they are. And now this is like typical, like really good programmers tend to build like very like these labyrinth of object graphs in their head and try and keep it all in their mind at the same time. This is one of the reasons why interruptions are so costly for us, is because we end up dropping those trees in our mind, and it ends up that rebuilding all that takes a good amount of time of swapping in. The great thing about Codebubble is that all this information, you can look at basically the stack simultaneously for all these different code paths that you're in. So you can say, okay, so I saw that this method thinks that this variable is set to here is set to A, but over here it's set to B. And so what happened in between? And you can look at all simultaneously, and you can even export it and mail it to your friends and your fellow developers. And so it's the big takeaway here with Codebubble is that, number one, that I'm a guy who loves lots of windows on my screen, and Xcode 4 was just, catastrophic to me, disastrous, and how it wanted me to work the way it worked, which is very much focused on one, and if you're lucky, two windows. And I always like to have up, maybe 6 or 10 at a time. And with Codebubble, it makes me feel even worse, Xcode 4's redesign, because Xcode 4 was all about, oh, we'll manage the windows for you, and we'll all put in one big window for you, and you can slide things around over. But the information density of code bubbles and the spatial perception of it just is so much better than Xcode 3 was. And to think that we actually have gotten worse, and when there's this like pretty clear way forward to kind of give you more and better information, it makes it feel even more prehistoric. But anyway.
So what was that about you being positive in this sense?
Good point.
And I can also point out, we're at our usual breakpoint. You might want to stop at 2 for this episode.
Oh my God, it's 41 minutes? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I'll can talk about, maybe I'll have to do the, you're right. I'll talk about the third topic maybe in another episode, or batch episode.
And also, I think Codebubbles themselves might be worthy of its own episode at some point. To go into more depth about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone should watch the video.
I will.
Okay. I do want to mention two more things about Codebubbles before we leave the topic and apparently wind up the show, because I got very excited. It's one of my favorite things. There's this project that was on Kickstarter called Lighttable. I don't know if you've heard about this project.
I've heard of Lighttables, but something that has to do with Codebubbles.
Yeah, yes. It's not really Codebubbles, but it's similar in ideas. Andrew, have you used something like Solver or Calca?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. And so essentially it's a worksheet. Hey, you're old Mac guy. What about MPW?
That's before my time still.
Okay. Yeah. So the idea behind Lighttable is that the demo is kind of Clojure scripty, I think. It might have just been Clojure, I'm not sure. But so it's Lispy, and I think that helps it somewhat. But they're adding more support for more languages. But it's similar in the idea that you kind of deal with these documents that evaluate, they're live documents that are evaluating as you're using them. And the idea that you can look at basically multiple chunks of code at the same time, and then when you modify something, a caller on the left-hand side of your screen, you can see how it bubbles down to the effect on the callee on the right-hand side of your screen in real time. So it's like a new way of kind of looking at is basically integrates the debugging experience into actually writing code. And so instead of having like this, you write code, chunk time to move over to debug time, it's much more of a fluid experience. I still think Codebubbles has the edge on it, although they're not strictly competitors. They overlap in a few ideas, but I think they're actually mostly complementary. And so I will put a link to the show notes in there. Apparently I need to. And one thing I want to mention about the Codebubbles is that Codebubbles, when you look at the YouTube video, you'll see it's all Java-ish, and you can actually download the Java implementation right now. It's off the brown.edu site that I'll include in the show notes. It's probably the best reason to install Java on your Mac is for you to actually try a little slice of the future here. And what's interesting is that Microsoft ended up hiring at least Andrew Bragdon. I think Steve Rice whatever, is I think he's still at Brown. So, but he has gone on to be, I think, the project leader, the PM, I think, project manager of two Microsoft projects that basically implement CodeBubbles in Visual Studio. And they're optional plugins, from what I understand. I haven't used them myself. But and they come in two flavors. There's Code Canvas and Debugger Canvas. Apparently, they thought Bubbles was just like maybe too childish or something like that, and Canvas was maybe a better idea. But they implement kind of, you know, I had a good blog posting on this. I'll link to in terms of how they differ from each other. Code Canvas tends to be kind of more of a code exploratory tool. I would liken it to Xcode's class modeler tool, which I believe you had a part of.
I did indeed.
Yeah. So it's kind of like their flavor of that. It's still pretty interesting in terms of how you kind of zoom into a project and how it keeps text files on screen and then draws kind of arrows between the code. So that's pretty interesting. But it's in my mind, it's really still it's not as great as CodeBubbles are. And Debugger Canvas is probably more similar to CodeBubbles in terms of a debugging experience. But again, one of the main benefits of CodeBubbles to me is that it kind of integrates the two experiences very nicely. So I'll put a link to a blog posting that I read that did a good job kind of laying out how these things interact and what the parts they kind of focus on. And apparently I am not talking about prototypical objects because we're already at 46 minutes. But yes, those are one of my favorite things too.
All right, so hopefully we'll get to that in some future episode. Mm-hmm. But for now, that's it. We'll see you next time.